Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Special Considerations for Male Domestic Violence Survivors. I'm Melissa Mercer, AILA's Education and Resources Assistant, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora digital library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below a resource file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. The discussion leader for this podcast is Cynthia Grooms Katz from Rockville, Maryland. Joining Cynthia is Cecilia Friedman-Levin, AILA BAWA U's and T's Committee Co-Chair from Des Moines, Iowa, and Edna Yang from Austin, Texas. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Cynthia.
Thank you so much. I founded the Immigration Law Offices of Cynthia A. Grooms, PC in 1999. I'm a member of both the New York and D.C. chapters of AILA, and I am chair of the AILA D.C. Webinar Committee. Edna Yang is the Director of Legal Services for American Gateways, formerly the Political Asylum Project of Austin, PAPA, a nonprofit association or organization, rather, that provides legal representation and advocacy to indigent immigrants in Central Texas. Cecilia Friedman-Levin is the Senior Policy Counsel at ASISTA, Immigration Assistance. And that's based in the Washington, D.C. area. She is co-chair of the AILA VAWA U&T Visa Committee. We've got five bullet points that we've identified today in this topic, and they are recognizing and overcoming institutional biases, improving client intake procedures to identify relief-eligible victims, number three, overcoming clients' own reluctance, four, evidentiary considerations, records, institutional help, abuse by client, and non-traditional forms of abuse. And finally, using prevailing gender and cultural stereotypes to show increased harm to your client. Improving client, and so now I'd like to start with recognizing and overcoming institutional biases, and that includes from adjudicators, for example, prosecutors, police, et cetera, against male survivors. If you would please go ahead, Cecilia, that would be great.
Yes, thank you. I think that where we wanted to start the conversation is talking about some common barriers for male victims of domestic violence. And first and foremost, I think that there are numerous cultural barriers and stereotypes around male survivors. And I think we're going to go talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But the idea that men are perpetrators of violence and can't themselves be victims or survivors is incorrect. And as advocates, I think that we need to think about how we discuss intimate partner abuse and how we frame intimate partner abuse, because it's not just about men abusing women. And to think about domestic violence in that way is really a disservice to LGBT victims and to men who are in heterosexual relationships who may be abused by women. And so while the statistics support that women are much more likely than men to be victimized by an intimate partner, it really isn't the whole picture. The CDC has a National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey, which has some pretty interesting statistics. For example, more than one in three women, or about 36%, and more than one in four men in the United States have experienced rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in their lifetime. And these statistics are worth checking out because I think it can help change people's perspective on who can be a survivor of domestic violence. And additionally, I think it's also important to keep in mind the rates of domestic violence in the LGBT community as well, because approximately 23% of LGBT men and 50% of LGBT women experience abuse from their intimate partners. And so stemming from these stereotypes about who is a victim and who is a perpetrator is a little bit about how our institutions respond to male survivors of domestic violence. Male victims may not feel comfortable reaching out for help and may fear calling the police because doing so may lead to their arrest or their persecution. Or even if male victims do call the police, prosecutors may decline to prosecute because they may view that violence against male survivors is somehow less serious. So for this reason, I think it's just important to educate ourselves about how existing protections extend to male survivors and what barriers they can face accessing those protections, and most likely kind of access to certain services and to housing. But it's important to realize that there are resources available to all victims, regardless of their gender identity or expression or their sexuality. And a really good place to start is the National Domestic Violence Hotline for access to services. According to the hotline's website, in 2013, 13% of the contact to the hotline identified themselves as male victims. And that's just the ones who called in. And you can assume that there are many more who are not accessing the hotline for help. And so, but there are protections available, including VAWA-based immigration relief, if necessary. And I know you hear some things that, you know, it's the Violence Against Women Act, but I think that you also, it's just important to remind people that the protections that exist and the resources that exist in that act extend to male survivors as well, including abused male spouses of U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents who might be able to avail themselves to a VAWA self-petition, but that male survivors are also able to get protection orders and emergency services in the same way as female survivors. So I think I just kind of outlined some of those kind of institutional barriers, why people may be reluctant to reach out for help, and then I think that's the ones we can start with. There are certainly many more, but for the purposes of time, we can just stick to those.
Thank you, Cecilia. That's a great segue into the next topic, the next section, which is improving client intake procedures. This is where we lay the foundation for building a case on behalf of someone, male or female, who has been a victim of domestic violence, who survived domestic violence. That starts with the consultation. That's where we can establish, as practitioners, trust and rapport. And that's at the beginning of the meeting. Some of these points may sound basic, but they're so important that we refresh our memory so we know this is what the person on the other side coming in for assistance may be thinking or may want us to anticipate questions that he or she may have. And, of course, here we're talking about male survivors. Introduce yourself and explain that you do what you do by clearly stating that you represent men and women in issues of family-based immigration, including domestic violence. I think that helps open the door for in-depth discussion. Explain the attorney-client privilege to attendees. If a potential client is accompanied by other people, determine how they are connected to the applicant and explain that at various times during the meeting, you may need to speak to each attendee separately. This way, no one feels excluded or left out, or particularly if the survivor is with an abuser, you don't want to give someone a heads up that might put someone in jeopardy. Ask the potential client what language is his first language and ask if the potential client is comfortable speaking now. That sort of reinforces what I'd said before about who's in the room, who's accompanied the person seeking advice. Acknowledge that you will have a lot of questions to ask, and particularly if there is a language barrier, you may need someone to interpret to bridge that barrier. And, of course, you always want someone that you want to take care in selecting who is that interpreter. Explain that you will be taking notes during the consultation or your meeting, and to make sure that you're doing this because you want to make sure that your client knows that you want to, quote-unquote, catch everything that the applicant is saying. reassure the applicant that you will be engaging in active listening. Conduct the consultation without family members, friends, spouses present. And that's when you get to the nuts and bolts of the grounds of eligibility, the past experiences that the person has had, basically getting to the bottom line of what brings that person into your office today. By encouraging candor and establishing trust, the applicant is more likely to share private, painful, and potentially embarrassing details to you, including any history of prior abuse and/or trauma. Ask if the applicant has ever told anyone, including clergy, friends, relatives, healthcare practitioners, about the domestic violence and whether he has ever been for help anywhere. I think that just gives us a little bit of an idea to go embracing our next topic, which is overcoming clients' own reluctance. So, Edna, if you'd please continue, that would be great.
Sure, Cynthia. So once you've completed the intake process and screened someone who might be a survivor of intimate partner violence, there is now a relationship that's developed where you have to ask that individual to open up a great deal and tell you details about a domestic violence situation that might be very personal and very difficult to discuss. So there are a lot of barriers that come up when working with survivors of intimate partner violence, and some of those might be even greater when you're working with actual male survivors. So some of the things to keep in mind are that some of these things might be very embarrassing or shameful to those male survivors. It's the same for female survivors, but there is, as Cecilia discussed before, a lot more cultural barriers and stereotypes about men and who they are, that they're not victims, that they may be perpetrators. So keeping that in mind when we delve deeper into working with our male victims will help as well, understanding the barriers that they face. There's also a fear that they may be seen as weak or that what they're doing in reporting the abuse that they've suffered will ruin their family, that they should be the person that keeps their family together and that they may be destroying their family and it would have a great impact on their kids. There's also fear that they may actually be accused in the end of manipulating the situation, that perhaps because they are the man in the relationship, that they're really the abuser and not the victim. And so these fears take a lot of time to overcome. You have to develop a trust relationship with your client, but it might be some of the tools that we use in our office are to really understand these barriers and face them head on. Some of the things that we do are to try and ask direct questions about physical violence, sexual violence, and verbal or emotional abuse, and asking these questions in a straightforward manner without judgment, and letting individuals know that these are very difficult questions to answer no matter what, but that these details are necessary in order to move forward with, for example, a VAWA case. Also, it's important to keep in mind that abuse is not always just physical assault, that it could be a pattern of coercive control or power. So there might be issues of verbal abuse, emotional abuse, control, financial abuse, manipulation that can come out. One of the things that we use in our office is a checklist that we've developed that's called the Has Anyone Ever checklist. And it starts off with simple questions like, has anyone ever threatened to harm you? Has anyone ever locked you in the house? Has anyone ever kicked you out of the house? Has anyone ever prevented you from calling for help? Simple questions that are yes, no questions, but that can lay the basis for your client to expand once they feel comfortable. You might use that checklist to get a basic understanding of the abuse that person suffered and then go into a little more detail as your trust relationship with your client strengthens and as your relationship develops. The other thing that we ensure that we do in our office to overcome those barriers that male survivors have are to have pamphlets about intimate partner violence that are not aimed solely at women. So a lot of those are available through the Texas Council on Family Violence. There might be other state organizations where you practice that have those types of brochures, pamphlets, posters. The National Domestic Violence Hotline might have other information that they can give to you where you can put these things up in your office so that that male survivors can see them and hopefully feel comfortable being able to open up with you.
Thank you, Edna. I was hoping now that we could move on to hear from the both of you, and, you know, of course, I will chime in if if there's something. I think particularly because the two of you specialize in this area, if you could just share some evidentiary considerations, like, for example, records, institutional help, you know, something, the evidence that we need to establish abuse by the client and non-traditional forms of abuse.
Sure, Cynthia.
I have a question. If you'd like, I can start with a question that we would all find germane. Have any of you seen any problems with documenting abuse claims for male survivors?
Yes, this is Edna. We've seen a lot of problems documenting abuse claims for male survivors. The first thing that comes up are negative records. So when you're working with male survivors, there actually may be negative records where the man might have been arrested, even though they were not the abusive party. Again, this might be because of cultural stereotypes or because of an escalated situation where the police might not have understood what was going on and then went to the man and arrested that individual as the perpetrator. There may also be arrests for DWI, drugs, public intoxication, other negative factors, and this may be because the survivor that you're working with has used drugs or alcohol as a coping mechanism for abuse. So understanding that those negative records exist and trying to work them into the story of abuse is a good way to overcome them. Additionally, we've also seen that there are that men who are victims of intimate partner violence seek help from mainly informal resources. So they may seek help through friends, neighbors, relatives, parents, and not through the National Domestic Violence Hotline or not through a shelter. There was a study that was done by the Journal of Family Violence that shows that two-thirds of the men use informal resources, including online support. So it's anonymous. It's something where their shame can be overcome. And so it's trying to get at these informal resources and sources and trying to document what the men have done in order to seek help. Cecilia, do you want to talk a little bit more about official records?
Yeah, sure.
May I just interject one thing while you were talking about the informal sources? This is Cynthia. I just wanted to add that sometimes there are men who go to formal resources or reach out to formal sources, but they don't give the full story. So, for example, I once had a client whose wife sprayed perfume in his eyes. He did go to the eye doctor. The eye doctor said, "Looks like you've got some kind of alcohol burn on your eyes. What happened?" And he did not tell the doctor how that happened. He said, "Oh, I must have spilled something, and my eyes are still burning. That's why I'm here." So that's something that could potentially be an obstacle. So I didn't want to interrupt, but I did want to interject that. And Cecilia, if you could just please, pick up the ball from here, that would be great.
No, and I think that both of you raise very important points in terms of accessing what we call systems evidence. And that is something that, we typically submit if we're doing a VAWA self-petition or a U visa case, which is that proof that a survivor accessed some kind of system or some kind of protection. And it might be that they did, but they didn't give the full story, like the example that you gave. Or they might not have a police report because that they didn't know how the police would react if they were to call for that protection. Would they themselves get arrested, or if there's other kind of immigration factors coming into play? And so we really need to kind of think about how the difficulty for survivors accessing the systems evidence, as we call it. And that police reports, if they exist, might minimize the abuse or have information that is actually just not correct, or access assistance from a mental health professional. And so I think that in those cases, the standard in VAWA is any credible evidence. And Congress created that standard in order to ease the evidentiary challenges that immigrant victims of domestic violence often face. And so really thinking about how to connect with those with the informal ways that people are seeking assistance. If a survivor is reaching out to a friend, could you get a letter or an affidavit from that friend saying that this person, that the survivor reached out to me, this is what happened, or that I was next door and I saw the perfume, you know, I saw the perfume being sprayed into the person's eyes. And so really thinking about ways to connect to those informal resources in order to support the VAWA claim or any kind of claim that you're making for immigration relief is really going to be important, looking at those secondary forms of evidence in order to support the case. I don't know if Edna or Cynthia have more to add to that.
About how to support. I don't have anything else. What about Edna? Is there anything you wanted to add?
Sure. I agree with everything that Cecilia has said. I also think that it's important that if you have a client that has sought only informal sources and resources, that you might actually want to give them referrals to more formal resources. So if they're having a very difficult time opening up to you or a difficult time dealing with the abuse that they've suffered, seeing if there are any mental health practitioners that might be able to help, seeing if you can refer to a shelter or any type of mental health professional that can assist the individual and also at the same time document abuse. And we've also used, especially when there aren't a lot of formal reports or other forms of records, and affidavits from expert witnesses who work in the field of intimate partner violence to explain what intimate partner violence consists of and some of the barriers and challenges that can arise when you're working with a male victim as well.
Right, and just to add to that, something that we commonly see in the course of our work is you might get RFEs saying, you know, you said that X happened and where's the proof of it? And I think it's important to explain any discrepancies in your individual declaration or personal statement. For example, I reached out and I went to the hospital, but I didn't explain what happened because I was embarrassed, because I felt that I wouldn't be believed or that it could create problems for me for these reasons. So if there is a gap in evidence, then being able to explain in the client's own words why a particular document may not exist. I didn't feel I could call the police because of how I might have been treated. I didn't feel like I could go and talk to a shelter program because I didn't know whether or not I would be accepted there. So really kind of utilizing an individual statement to explain any gaps in evidence and why a particular piece of the puzzle might not exist in this case, I think is also a really important way to help alleviate any problems with the evidence in supporting these cases.
I'd just like to interject while we're talking about our client statements. I have found, this is Cynthia, I have found that sometimes clients are quite uncomfortable, particularly if the abuser has used foul language, if you will, that they don't want to repeat that language. First of all, the language is very demeaning oftentimes, and the words are not very, quote-unquote, polite. How do you, the two of you, suggest addressing that when the client does need to communicate in his statement what happened, but, you know, has this barrage of language? Sometimes it's culture-specific. Sometimes they're words that we, quote-unquote, would never use in polite society.
This is Edna. Again, I think some of that is developing a trust relationship with your client and explaining the importance of documenting their experience. So while they may be embarrassed to share certain words or threats or insults that were thrown at them, when you explain to them the importance of it for their VAWA application and for their case overall, and give them time, not rush them and say, we need to do it today, but give them time to process that, I think it can be very helpful. I think even if there are not direct translations of some of the insults that are used against an individual, putting it down in their their native language in an affidavit, and then next to it, putting as close a translation as possible is also very powerful. And so as your trust relationship develops with your client, I think that a lot of these things do come out. VAWA applications don't get done in a week or 2 weeks. They can take a lot of time. As the client starts to open up and trust you, I think more information will come out and can be placed in their affidavits, and more evidence that might not have been there in the beginning, or realized where your client realized that might be evidence in the beginning, starts to develop and come out as your relationship develops.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the other tip that I find is to be helpful is to give an explanation of why you are asking the questions that you're asking. And to say, I'm going to ask you about things that were said, things that would happen, and to this end. I'm not just asking them out of my own personal curiosity about your life. I'm asking them because we need to really understand and explain what happened if we're going to be presenting this type of case to the Immigration Service. And I would also say, in cases where you're not dealing with battery, where you are dealing with extreme cruelty in the context of VAWA, or even if you're dealing with substantial harm in a U visa case, is that you could say something like, my spouse called me this name. And I think that to build upon that is to ask a little bit about how that made a person feel. And to really say, you know, okay, they called me a name, and this is why it affected me in this way. Maybe there is a cultural reason, a religious reason, that was particularly damaging for that individual survivor. So not only ascertaining kind of what happened, what names were called, what language is used against them, but really trying to understand about how that statement or how that action made that individual feel, which can be difficult, I think, working with any survivor of domestic violence, is kind of building that trust, as Edna mentioned, and creating that safe space, which is why I also think that working with non-attorney advocates, domestic violence, sexual assault advocates, or any other kind of social workers or professionals who can help your client get to that space where they are comfortable sharing the story in that way.
I think that also underscores that we're working with what people bring to the table, and that we are also spotting issues in terms of some people do definitely benefit from ongoing counseling. Would you all agree with that?
Yes, definitely.
And what about situations where the person, for example, the person who's actually the perpetrator has a criminal history? Was there a pattern of abusive behavior with others? How did the two of you deal with those situations, and how do you identify that has, in fact, occurred?
Well, I think asking for the criminal history in general, requesting open records, is an important step. Especially if your client has been arrested when they are actually the victim, getting a whole history of arrests within that relationship to see if there have been more than one arrest, if the abusive spouse, who is not your client, has actually had a history of arrests as well, or a history of at least police calls where there has been abusive language, domestic disturbances where no arrest has been made, to show that there has been a pattern where your client hasn't been the aggressor is helpful for the case. Also, if there are other records with children involved where there might be CPS records, Child Protective Services records, where it shows a pattern of abuse from the perpetrator using the children or even abusing the children, that also might be helpful for your case in documenting how your client is actually the victim.
And I would kind of, in support of that, You know, so that it's very important to get all that information up front, and that people, you know, anyone for obvious reasons will be very uncomfortable, you know, discussing maybe their criminal history or their immigration history with an attorney. But I would just go back to the point, which is why it's so important to provide context to these questions. This is what I'm trying to ask. This is what we're going to try to figure out so that we don't have problems down the road. Because, you know, as any immigration practitioner knows, that having surprises during the process is kind of an awful thing to happen. And so really building the trust with your with a client, particularly with a survivor of domestic violence, is going to be very important to try to say, okay, this is a safe space for us to talk about these negative facts and address them in the context of the application and provide some kind of explanation or provide some kind of balance or more kind of context around them if they are a pattern of abuse in a way that an abuser is kind of using the system against a survivor.
Do you see that also as a way to bulk up good moral character in general?
Yeah, I think that looking at an overall history of abuse and looking at the overall relationship can add to your client's good moral character, especially if your client has prior arrest, but you can link them to the abuse and then also show their involvement in their children's lives, for example, or other things that they have done that will help their overall good moral character. Again, I think, like Cecilia said, it's really important to put those things in your client's own words and to explain how the abuse has affected them and what impact it's had on their life, but how they've overcome that as well. So, Cecilia, do you have anything else you want to add on that?
No, I think that covers a lot of it, is trying to getting that in your own words, into the client's own words and perspective. And providing as much kind of balance and explanation to those facts is just going to be very important.
So let's talk about using prevailing gender and cultural stereotypes to show increased harm to our clients. How can we best educate immigration adjudicators and others about gender and cultural stereotypes surrounding male victims?
I think that we need to kind of start with ourselves as advocates and really get a sense of looking at intimate partner violence in different types of relationships and in different cultural contexts for people with different gender identities or expressions and in LGBT relationships as well, and really understanding the different barriers to accessing these services and different stereotypes that exist across multiple contexts. And there's a lot of great resources, which I think that we'll be able to provide you after the podcast, which I think explore some of those. And I think it's really important to start looking at the client as a whole person and what experiences and does our client bring to the table, and what may be some barriers based upon their gender identity, based upon their sexual orientation, or what might some of these barriers or language access cultural considerations, what are some of the barriers that people are facing that why might some of these resources and evidence might not be available, and being able to first, I think, understand those different things for ourselves, and then being able to find those resources to connect CIS adjudicators, to connect social service agencies, to be able to educate others with that information, I think is kind of a good starting place.
I would also add to that and echo what Cecilia said before, that your client's own actual statement is probably the most powerful piece of evidence that you can provide in a VAWA application or a U visa application to discuss what gender and cultural stereotypes they may suffer from or what those barriers are for them to actually report abuse. So I think it's very powerful for them to explain why it's so difficult to come forward why they had difficulty coming forward if they didn't access resources, why that was, and what stereotypes and barriers kind of block them from doing that. And then also bulk that part up with maybe research on cultural norms from the home country where your client is from. If there are country conditions or country condition experts that you can also use that actually strengthen your client's own testimony about the barriers that he faced when reporting abuse, that would be great. And again, research about gender stereotypes, which Cecilia had mentioned before and which we'll provide the resources for at the end of the podcast.
And this is Cynthia. I'd just like to reiterate that addressing stereotypes, it's really about dispelling stereotypes, as we have, all three of us have indicated during the entire podcast. A lot of times, you know, like we said, we are all what we bring to the table. And some adjudicator may look or think about a man saying, well, this guy is bigger than the person who he says harmed him. And just dispelling that physical size doesn't necessarily signify that a person is totally protected from any harm. And just sort of reminding an adjudicator of that, whether it's reminding on paper, face-to-face, in court, for example, just reminding we have to dispel this stereotype. This is this person who has survived this abuse. And yes, this person might be 6 feet and the abuser might be, you know, 5'2", but yes, this did take place, and this is the manifestation, just pulling all of those factors together and sort of, like we said before, our storytelling on behalf of our client to help our clients articulate that abuse that that person has, in fact, survived. Is there anything else that comes to mind that the two of you would like to share with our members before we close?
I think that the only thing that I would kind of echo is, you know, something that I think Edna brought up in the beginning of this is even kind of recognizing abuse and being able to kind of maybe pull out your power and control wheel or pull out these behaviors to recognize abuse in different relationships, I think is really important. And for people who may not know or have a kind of sense that what's going on in their relationship does kind of meet what we would consider to be intimate partner violence or domestic violence. And so I just wanted to kind of support that and raise that up in terms of a first step in having this conversation. If you're kind of noticing something with clients that might seem strange, is kind of bringing out these checklists that Edna mentioned, bringing out these tools to even identify it in the first place, I think is going to be really important. And thank you for the space today to be able to talk about this.
And thank you for the two of you for your contribution. Thank you, audience, for listening to this podcast. This concludes our session. So long.